Mesa says it finally has a deal to fill one of the city's historic buildings. And city officials are optimistic about the future.
State-of-the-art meets old, and you preserve the story of Mesa's history. You can't underestimate the value in that.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, moving forward to protect the past. Also, Arizona looks into regulating sober living homes.
A Valley Arts group gets some love on the national stage.
And another one tries something a little different.
We found this like silver leather floor-length coat. So there's a lot of elements like that we kind of added so that there was a little more edge or toughness to it all.
Plus, starting up a business, and we go behind the mask.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic on the 101 northbound in the West Valley. An accident at Peoria has the right lane blocked. And an I-10 westbound at Buller, that's in the West Valley, an accident there has three lanes blocked. Look for sunny skies across the valley for the rest of the day with a high of 76 at 75 right now.
Salt River Project, the nonprofit utility which is not regulated by the Arizona Corporation Commission, has been considering increasing costs for its customers who use solar power. If SRP's board goes ahead with the changes, that could lead to it hitting the rooftop solar customers harder than other utilities in the nation. And today was scheduled to be the day when SRP heard again from the public and stakeholders and then decided whether to up its rates. KJZZ's senior business correspondent Christina Hansen has been at the meeting since this morning and joins me now. Christina, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. So what has gone on in the several hours you've been down there today?
Well, so far it started out this morning with about a crowd of roughly 200 people, and it started out by staff explaining some slight adjustments to the proposal that it was making to the board for consideration today. It includes, as for the 3.9% rate increase, they're now proposing to phase that in for customers for the first year. And then as for the $50 fee that solar customers would have to pay, they would also have a longer grandfathering clause, so they would be grandfathered into their existing rates. And that grandfather would also transfer with the house to the new owner of the house if ever it's sold. And then so there's kind of some booing from the crowds, and there's kind of some cheering and clapping from the crowds as staff was explaining its position, and the solar industry then went up and spoke, and then it went into a public comment period, and the board will potentially vote about around 3.
Christina, let's come back to the mood situation, because there have been some public meetings leading up to this. There have been some activist folks who have decided they really want to make a lot of noise. So even though there was some booing, how did this mood generally seem to compare with other public meetings, or at least what people have told you about those public meetings?
It seems a little bit more subdued today, for sure. I definitely think the board has done a decent job trying to keep things pretty controlled. I did speak to the SRP spokesman, and he said that he thinks things have kind of calmed down a little bit because of they're being a little bit more generous with their grandfathering clauses for the solar customers. So I think there's several reasons why it's a little bit more subdued today. I found it kind of interesting that it was, that every seat was basically taken early in the morning, and then by the time public comment period rolled around, the crowd had really thinned out.
So as you said, they're expected to vote around 3 this afternoon. Would you care to place a bet on how they're going to vote?
Based on all of the comments, there's been a lot of feelings from the public and from the solar industry that this has been unfair, and it's been a decision that's being made too fast. This proposal has only been on the table for 3 months, and people have really been expressing that they feel, a lack of transparency by SRP and lack of engaging stakeholders. So, it is possible that the vote could be tabled. So I guess we'll just have to see.
KJZZ senior business correspondent Christina Hansen. Christina, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today, the Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 approving net neutrality. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said the policy will ensure, quote, that no one, whether government or corporate, should control free open access to the Internet.
Last year, a federal appeals court ruled the FCC did not have sufficient regulatory power over broadband after a legal challenge by Verizon. That action prompted the FCC to reclassify broadband in a way to gain broader regulatory powers.
Here to help set this historic moment for net neutrality in context is Marvin Amori, a Washington, D.C.-based First Amendment lawyer and internet policy expert. Marvin, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Right off the bat here, how can this be enforced? How can the FCC make stick what it's doing? In the old days of broadcast, it was about granting or revoking of licenses.
You know, in these days, it'll simply be, if they are discriminating against websites or trying to charge new fees and tolls that shut out competitors and startups, they'll be able to file complaints at the FCC. And the FCC will have the authority to tell the cable and phone companies, hey, Comcast, cut it out. And so it'll probably be through what lawyers call injunctions, telling them to stop doing things, and through fines, forcing them to pay when they violate the law.
How do you think this evolves? Because, you know, it's hard to see how we can kind of conceptualize the internet. It's not something that's very centralized. It doesn't emerge from a particular point like a broadcast signal does. It's everywhere, but yet it's also tiny little grains of sand as well. How do you see this in terms of maintaining this net neutrality?
So the beautiful thing is we've kind of had net neutrality all along, because the basic technologies of the internet supported net neutrality. They didn't really permit discrimination, right? It wasn't until a few years ago that the phone and cable companies got the sophisticated technology to be able to know in real time if you were using Skype or Google Voice. And so in a lot of ways, we're just keeping the internet the same way it's always been.
Perhaps this isn't a victory for anyone. This is just a kind of a capitulation, because there's really no choice for the U.S. but to do it this way, since the rest of the world has adopted this principle long before us.
You know, the U.S. could have actually changed global policy if they made the wrong decision. And last May, the proposed order in this case would have permitted fast lanes and slow lanes on the internet, would have permitted new commercial deals at various prices. Comcast could have made YouTube the preferred carrier nationally on their online networks ahead of Vimeo or any other online video provider. I mean, it could have been a complete cableized and controlled internet. That's the world that was proposed in this proceeding. And if we went in that direction, you could bet that Deutsche Telekom and the Spanish telecom companies and the Italian companies and the Chinese companies were going to want a piece of that action as well. And so the American companies would have been cutting deals all over the world. And you couldn't just have, you know, a college dropout like David Karp start Tumblr, a grad student like Larry Page start Google. Right? Most of the great American tech companies were started by dropouts, by outsiders, by non-Americans, people with no money and no connections who were able to compete in a level playing field.
Finally, is that vision that you described of the Comcasts and the Vimeos and the YouTubes of the world still alive and well? And will it be hashed out in court over the next 10 years?
It is still alive and well in the hopes and dreams of Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon. I mean, AT&T was just salivating at the idea of charging websites different prices, of just gouging them as they gouge their own consumers. And I think that the real reason why they won't be able to get it, at least my hope is they won't be able to get it, is because the American people have stood up and have come to understand that the internet is a delicate thing that can be destroyed by law and the phone and cable companies. And I think it'll be very hard for any politician to side with the cable and phone companies after the huge outpouring in favor of net neutrality this year.
First Amendment lawyer and veteran internet policy expert Marvin Amori there. Thanks so much, Marvin.
Thank you.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Around this time last year, we took a trip to one of the Valley's most endangered historic places, the Mesa Citrus Growers Association building at Broadway and Country Club. The building closed in 2010, but yesterday Mesa announced it had found a new tenant, Autoline Industries. The company manufactures and distributes high-end auto parts and will expand into the building. Construction is expected to start later this spring and take about a year. Bill Jabginiak is Mesa's Economic Development Director.
Autoline was able to approach us and talk to the city about the historic property. And really, this is about preserving part of Mesa's history with an adaptive reuse. And I think this is a great fit. Anytime you can bring manufacturing into the heart of your downtown, it's a great story.
So what of the original building will stay? What goes?
Well, I think some of that, I think you're going to see a significant interior renovation. But the exterior, the character of the building will be retained. But obviously, you have to prepare the building for manufacturing use. So you'll see some beefed up floors and things like that. But again, when you're spending $3.8 million to renovate 70,000 square feet, you have to make it efficient for your own use. And this is about tripling their workforce and bringing, again, manufacturing back to the United States.
Is there language in the deal with Autoline Industries to make sure that there is some semblance of historic preservation going on there?
Well, it's right now it's their pledge. The details will come out in their plans and what they actually submit for building permits along the way. We do not have a formal development agreement, as one was not necessary. This is purchasing a privately owned piece of property, and we're certainly cooperating in the renovation effort.
This is a building that had been on the Arizona Preservation Foundation's most endangered places, historic places list. What does it mean to the city that this building will have a new use and will be in some way preserved?
You know, a lot of my career has been done across the country, and preserving part of a community's history is extremely important. We've done that with several of the buildings in downtown. Here's another chance to demonstrate that. This is important. This is Mesa's history. Once it's knocked down, it's gone forever. Here's a situation where adaptive reuse is a great fit. They've pledged to work with us on the historic piece of things. And I think what's interesting now is when you're getting in and updating mechanical and plumbing and electrical systems to make it modern and safe and sanitary. But it's important that, again, state-of-the-art meets old, and you preserve the story of Mesa's history. You can't underestimate the value in that.
Bill Jabginiak is Mesa's Economic Development Director. Bill, thanks so much.
You have a great day.
But some preservationists think the city could have gotten more value out of the building. Vic Linoff, president of the Mesa Preservation Foundation, is one of them.
Well, like everyone else, I just heard about it yesterday afternoon, and it's a mixed set of feelings. First, if I understand correctly, their intent is to keep the historic building, and that is very good news because it represents the last example of the citrus processing industry in the valley. That said, I'm disappointed in the intended use of the building. We did have some people waiting in the wings, if this sale would have fallen through, that would have opened up the building as a public space. If you think of Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco or Faneuil Hall in Boston, that would have made it more accessible to the public. And I think in the end probably would bring in more revenue and certainly would employ more people than what Autoline is suggesting.
What do you think having this company in this building will mean both for Mesa and for historic preservation in the valley?
Well, as I say, if they follow through on their expressed intent to save the building, that's very positive because, as we all know, buildings can have multiple lives as time goes by. Anything that brings activity into the city and employment is good. But is that the best use for a historic property? I wonder a little bit. And one of the things that we've also looked at is the Broadway corridor as it runs from Country Club East is a pretty depressed area. We had hoped that if the Citrus Growers Building could have been developed into a public use space, that could have been the catalyst for revitalizing Broadway, which would be a real plus for the city of Mesa.
Well, so do you think that you have learned anything during the negotiations and sort of the working to get to this point with this building that you might be able to apply to other historic buildings so that maybe your opinion isn't so mixed but more on the positive side?
Well, what you learn from all of these experiences, and we were fairly cognizant of that, is maybe we need to be more proactive. We were, as a historic preservation organization, out in the field trying to put together the right interests for that property. And as I say, you know, you're talking about quite a bit of money, so it's not an easy deal to put together. And maybe we should have been a little more proactive. Maybe we should have looked at the possibility of some grants, things of that sort, that would help somebody that wanted to restore the building, as I say, to a more active public use.
Vic Linoff with the Mesa Preservation Foundation. Vic, thanks as always.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Coming up, the New York Times has called Ballet Arizona one of the best in the country, but does that matter locally?
There's still a stigma here about if it's from Arizona, it can't really be good.
Raising the Valley's arts profile one ballet at a time. It's The Show. And good afternoon. Checking Valley traffic at this hour. There's an accident on the 101 northbound in the West Valley at Peoria Avenue, and it's blocking the right lane. Also, watch out for a collision in the West Valley, I-10 westbound at Bullard. That's blocking the shoulder. We're expecting partly cloudy skies for tonight around the valley, with overnight lows expected to be around 50 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 16%. We have clear skies and 75 at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Tony Award winner Brian Stokes Mitchell sings classics from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Simply Broadway, Saturday, March 7th. Tickets at scottsdaleperformingarts.org.
Last year, we told you about how some Valley communities were dealing with sober living homes, places for people to live once they came out of treatment centers. In general, cities have been taking up the issue, but a bill working its way through the legislature would have the state health department regulate the facilities. Representative Noel Campbell of Prescott is the measure sponsor and ran on this issue last year.
About 7 years ago, when I was just a citizen, we started getting an influx of these drug rehabilitation houses. Now, you got to know Prescott's an older demographic. It's an older community. And it was unusual to see all these young men. It looked like a frat house. But then we realized that it was more than a frat house. It was a drug rehabilitation, that these were drug abusers who were supposedly seeking treatment. These young men, by and large, have problems with drugs. And there's been conflict with the residents about trash pickup and leaving trash around and walking down the middle of the street in groups, somewhat intimidating. So over a seven-year period, we tolerated it, we complained to the city, and nothing was done until lately, when we had a city hall, had a meeting. I think about 300 to 400 residents just came down and raised hell. And not knowing who owns them, the city couldn't inspect them, could not do a fire and health and safety code inspection, because drug abusers, like alcohol abusers, are a protected class under federal law. People with Disability Act gives them a special status, and as such, under federal law, you can pack 8 of them, unrelated adults, into a single family residence. So therein lies the conflict.
Is it your intention to regulate these facilities or shut them down?
No, my intention is to bring these drug rehabilitation houses under some form of state licensure. And the reason for that is that if they're licensed, they have to have a whole protocol and series of events that have to be above board and transparent.
Some of the cities in the Valley, especially, that have some of these sober living homes have come up with ordinances dealing with how far apart they need to be and other things
right.
like that. Why should the state come in and do this when basically
right.
Prescott is having a problem?
Well, I'll tell you. The city of Prescott did do a zoning ordinance. They said you can only have them 1,200 feet apart. They also tried to limit the number that could live in a house from 8 to 6. Well, immediately somebody filed a complaint with HUD, and now HUD has filed a formal complaint against the city of Prescott saying cease and desist, and so the city is and basically being sued by the federal government.
Would state regulations somehow be able to avoid problems with the feds?
Yes, it would, because HUD is concerned more about a housing problem. And my bill deals with a medical treatment issue. And if you're getting medical treatment with a licensed facility, then my position is that you need to come under the umbrella of state licensing. That is not in conflict with the housing issue that HUD is addressing.
State Representative Noel Campbell, a Prescott Republican, is the sponsor of House Bill 2563. He says he's trying to come up with a compromise before the measure goes up for debate in the full House. But the owner of a company that runs sober living homes sees the proposal differently. Gonzalo Ardovan is the owner and founder of Carla Vista Sober Living, which has 13 facilities in Arizona, although not in Prescott, and 10 in other states.
In my opinion, they're trying to regulate at a state level for an issue that's happening in Prescott. Don't agree with it.
Do you think that there is a way that the state could regulate facilities like yours?
I think there's a way to regulate it. I think each city is doing a great job doing it currently. I think Prescott has failed to do so.
So in your mind, then, is this sort of regulation best done at the local level as opposed to having the state do it?
Absolutely, because at the end of the day, it's going to be monitored at the local level.
What kinds of things have you found that cities have wanted to regulate with your facilities?
You know, I think, going back to the Prescott issue, the major issue is the clustering. And one of the things that the local area in an ordinance can regulate is the separation distance. For example, both Chandler and Gilbert have a 1,200-foot separation between sober living homes. That would eliminate that clustering issue that Prescott currently has.
Do you think that regulations that may be approved by the state should apply both to companies like yours that have multiple sober living homes, as well as facilities that are just run by individuals?
I absolutely agree on the regulation on the local level. I think it raises the bar not only in safety but in accountability. You know, when you're bringing it up to a state level, though, it's going to be hard to monitor. Who's going to monitor it? I think by this bill, what they're ultimately trying to do is make, they're going to be in conflict with the Federal Housing Act. There's current issues now in California where it's being challenged, and it's in federal courts right now. And I think that's what's going to happen here with this bill if it proceeds in the manner it's written right now. Because at the end of the day, sober living homes are unlicensed facilities. And we're a protected class through the Federal Housing Act, and that will still maintain.
Do you get the sense that ultimately this bill aims to put facilities like yours out of business?
Absolutely. The way that it's currently written, that's exactly what it will do.
Do you get the sense that this year's bill will be it as far as bills in the legislature dealing with sober living homes? I mean, do you think this is going to continue to be something that comes up?
I'm not sure. My opinion is this is an issue. All being said, I think Prescott is saturated with sober homes. That's honestly why we did not enter that market. It's overly saturated. I think it's a market that really does need help. They've gone to the state for help, and I think it needs to be handled at a local level.
Gonzalo Ardovan is owner and founder of Carla Vista Sober Living Homes. Gonzalo, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
The fight for survival among the Valley and state's more traditional arts companies is a long-running one. When will a game changer come along to get more people in the community to recognize that the Phoenix area is producing world-class performances? How does a glowing review in the New York Times sound? Earlier this month, the paper's dance critic called Ballet Arizona one of the best in the nation. I asked the company's longtime artistic director, Ebe Anderson, what kind of impact that review is going to have.
I'm very happy that the review is from him and he's saying what he's saying, which is very generous, I would say. Does it change? I would like to think that it's changed, but people need to know it about here in Phoenix. You know, I don't know how many people read the New York Times. The problem in this city is a lot of people, if you don't seek it out, you don't know what's happening in the city. This is a huge city, 5 million, one of the biggest in America. It still behaves in many ways like a small city. One aspect of a quality of life, apart from the blue sky, is to have diversity, culture. And we are one aspect of that. And I think many times people don't actually know what's going on here. They don't even know that there's a company here. There's still a stigma here about if it's from Arizona, it can't really be good.
In order for a company to be strong, you would want to expand your audience. The Nutcracker, of course, is the annual event. There was the event at the Desert Botanical Gardens. But as an artist, would you like the audience to grow based on the absolute best, most challenging work you're doing? Or do you just want, or are you okay with more people just watching whatever performances are put on?
First of all, we have to survive. You have to see it dollar and cents, which it all comes down to. How much money can you raise? How many people can you get in the seat? And if that is not balanced, of course, we won't survive. That's a given. But I always try to give them something that they have not seen before here, or something, a different aspect of what ballet or dance can be. So that's always a challenge when you go in and see. But I feel that that's even a challenge when you go in and see Swan Lake. For instance, this year when we did Swan Lake, we had 24 swans instead of 18. And that made a completely different ballet of what we had done before. So when people say, oh, I saw it 3 years ago. No, you did not. Because this version is completely another version.
Do you think you've changed? Have you become more flexible, not with your dancers, but with the expectations for the audience?
Nah, I don't think so. No, I mean, you know, the older you get, the more you know, and the more you sort of, you are maybe more at ease when you get older, but I think it's actually the contrary.
Well, has that aspect been unchanged in the 15 years? Have you seen, even as theater companies and traditional arts companies expand, have you seen that, again, are there ups and downs?
Yes and no. I do think newspapers today, apart from maybe the big, big papers, they don't really support the local scene. Not enough. You know, it's been like become this homogenized world that is tiny, and they all talk about whatever, Miley Cyrus, and, you know, things that has nothing to do with Arizona. We read about the same thing. We see the same things. We listen to the same things. And that's not really what the world is. There's a world right outside your door. Well, that is, you know, Arizona. It's not New York. It's not L.A.
Ballet Arizona Artistic Director Ebe Anderson.
A former killer whale trainer at SeaWorld has said the animals are too intelligent to be kept in captivity doing tricks. Dwindling audiences at SeaWorld's three theme parks have been compounded by the documentary Blackfish, a film which accused SeaWorld of covering up the killing and injuring of trainers by the giant mammals.
Now with the firing of its chief executive and the company's share price halved, SeaWorld must decide if killer whale shows are the future. The BBC's Alistair Leithhead has the story.
Huge, beautiful killer whales leap out of the water, swimming around the stadium, splashing the crowd.
Hello everyone, my name is Christy.
The trainers stand on the stage and feed them fish, banned now by law over safety grounds to swim in the pool with them.
It's a daily spectacle that brings tens of thousands of people to SeaWorld every week. But numbers are down. The company's struggling with attitudes towards killer whales being kept in captivity and questions over whether shows like this really have a long-term future.
In captivity, they're all psychologically traumatized.
This is the trailer to the documentary Blackfish. It sparked controversy over SeaWorld's treatment of the killer whales and the trainers killed and injured by them.
They blamed her.
I disagree vehemently with the film. We disagree vehemently with the film. There's a lot of mistruths in that film.
Dr. Christopher Dold is SeaWorld's chief vet.
Our killer whales are thriving here at SeaWorld. They're very healthy. They live long lives. We're not taking anything away from them by having them in this habitat. It's just different from what they experience in the wild. We work all day doing nothing but caring for these killer whales, watching them, paying attention to them, studying them, contributing to science so that we, as a society, can better understand them.
the man in this slick video presentation disagrees. The old footage shows former trainer John Hargrove performing the most astonishing tricks with a killer whale. He's propelled out of the water on its nose and then surfs on the animal's back. It took years to build this remarkable relationship, but he's left SeaWorld not without regrets.
You know, I look back on it, some of my memories are priceless and I cherish those, and other memories are heartbreaking. The whales are so bored. What do they have? It's just a pool with concrete painted blue walls. And it's simply not enough for these animals that have this level of intelligence. They regurgitate their food because they're bored. They wear down their teeth because they're bored. They fight because they're bored. We have aggression issues toward the trainers because they're bored. Once you know the things to look for, you're like, oh, yeah, that's not right.
But the killer whales, also known as orcas, are a huge attraction for kids. They're just behind a huge glass viewing screen. A family with a young calf. You can't see them like this in the wild.
Okay. So this entire area here would be underwater when Blue World Project comes online.
And SeaWorld's San Diego president, John Riley, says a $100 million expansion of the pool would help whale welfare. It was announced after Blackfish.
It's our goal every day to inspire and educate people about these magnificent animals.
But do you think that the end is in sight for performing killer whale shows?
The exercise that people see our whales do in shows, the natural behaviors, would have to continue for their own health, for their own well-being, whether there were people in the seats or not.
Okay, these whales are definitely heading south. These are southbound. Every year these whales,
there, can you see them?
She blows right in front of us.
Well, this is a very different experience altogether. I'm on a whale-watching boat off the coast of Los Angeles. We're here, eyes peeled, trying to catch a glimpse. We've seen one gray whale already, but the chances of seeing a killer whale here, well, you've got to be really lucky.
Keeping them away from their family members, taking them out of their natural habitat, they don't thrive and stay as healthy and successful as they do in the wild.
We saw a blowhole spray and a tail fin. Diane Alps has spent years studying orcas in the wild.
100 years ago, we would have bears in little skirts dancing on shows at circuses, or elephants in little top hats. We've changed. We understand now more about the biology of the animal, and it's time to start looking at that for killer whales and large marine mammals.
The killer whales back at SeaWorld are now all bred in captivity. If released, they wouldn't survive in the wild. The newborn calf will live for maybe 50 years. So even if the show stopped tomorrow, ending killer whales in captivity would take a generation.
That's the BBC's Alistair Leithhead in San Diego.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Matt Smith. I teach welding. A lot of people come here with no skills of welding and no skills of being an artist. And within 8 weeks, they're coming out of here with tons of art projects.
I made arrows, I made flowers, I like to make things that spin in the wind. That's why, that's actually why I started taking welding, because I couldn't grow anything. This way I don't have to water them or anything, and I can have all kinds of colors.
Oh, metal, you can do almost anything with metal. That's one of the things I try to teach them, how you can make it flow and look like a piece of paper.
That was welding instructor Matt Smith and one of his students, MJ Barrett, at the Mesa Arts Center. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just want to borrow our blowtorch, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, the Valley's startup scene is improving, so what's behind it?
We have a lot of very active young entrepreneurs, and at the core of an entrepreneurial ecosystem are, of course, the entrepreneurs.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Hope you're having a great Thursday. Valley weather for tonight. We're looking for clear skies and lows in the lower 50s. Should be partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 72, and a chance for rain comes our way this weekend. Currently, we have mostly sunny skies and 75 degrees. Meanwhile, on the Valley freeways, an accident on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at Southern. There's also a collision on the 101 northbound in the West Valley at Peoria Avenue. It's blocking the right lane.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at AJsFineFoods.com.
Today, Now News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The White House is not confirming or denying reports that the masked militant known as Jihadi John, seen in videos of beheadings by the self-proclaimed Islamic State group, is a university graduate who was raised in London. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest did say,
I can tell you that the United States' commitment and the president's commitment to ensuring that we find and hold accountable the terrorists who are responsible for the murders of American citizens has never been stronger.
A Minneapolis teenager who was accused of trying to travel to Syria to join Islamic State militants has pleaded guilty in federal court. 18-year-old Abdullahi Youssef entered a plea to one count of conspiracy to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. FBI agents halted him last year as he was trying to board a plane for Turkey. He faces a maximum prison sentence of 15 years. The director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, says the assaults against a vulnerable American internet infrastructure are on the rise.
Cyber threats. Attacks against us are increasing in frequency, scale, sophistication, and severity of impact.
Clapper was testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee today. He was discussing the latest U.S. intelligence appraisal of the top dangers facing the United States. Across the Carolinas, people are digging out from a mix of snow and ice that made driving very dangerous today. Bianca Johnson describes the problem she had on a highway in Raleigh, North Carolina.
I was driving less than 40 miles per hour in the middle lane, and then all of a sudden my car just started sliding, and it spun around a good three times before smashing into the guardrail. The guardrail is the only thing that stopped my car.
The winter storm left tens of thousands in the South without power today. Forecasters in Georgia are warning of slick roads later today as melting snow refreezes. On Wall Street today, stock prices were mixed. The Dow closed down 10 points, but the Nasdaq Composite Index was up 20. This is NPR News from Washington.
We're always looking for the next big thing, right? Especially in tech. Scott Snibby thinks he may have found it. He's CEO of iGroove, which helps people create fan music videos, and he'll be speaking this afternoon in Tempe as part of ASU's Digital Culture Speaker Series.
So what I'm going to talk about is the history of music and visuals and where they're going today, starting from things like the LP, you know, the long-playing record, which was actually this amazing, you know, almost five-sensory object that you could smell, touch, hear, and look at with all of its artwork. And then the evolution to MTV, which was kind of a surprise that music became so visual and with the video medium in the 80s. And now there's a big question as to where music is going today, you know, with Spotify and YouTube and things like that.
So what do you think is the next big thing?
Well, if you look at things like Twitter and Instagram, Twitter was like its sentences, essentially. So, you know, if some writer had told you everyone in the world is going to be writing a sentence a day and sharing it with everyone else 10 years ago, everyone might have laughed. And same thing with square photos. It used to be just nerdy people that carried around a Rolleiflex to get these, you know, funny, arty photos. And then Instagram came out and turned that into a worldwide phenomenon. And we believe it's time for music video to go in the same direction. If you look on YouTube, there's a lot of fan music videos. You know, you see people making their own Harlem Shake videos and Gangnam Style and things like that. But it's really difficult to make those videos right now. So what we're making is a kind of social network for music video.
Do you think that anything is lost in the music when you're able to see it and you're able to do something other than just sit and listen to it or jog and listen to it or whatever you're doing and listening to it?
Well, the thing about music is that music is the most powerful emotional medium, right? There's no other medium that transforms your state of mind instantly. You know, you can put on a song and you can instantly be transformed from sad to happy, happy to sad, or to some other world, to someone else's point of view in a way that, you know, a painting or even a movie doesn't do for you. But music is usually combined with something else. It's very, very rare that people sit and close their eyes or sit in a couch or an easy chair and listen to music, you know, as a kind of monosensory experience. So our feeling is that, you know, the way people enjoy music today is already multisensory. Like you said, it's when they're at a party, it's when they're running, or it's as ambient music while they're working. So it turns out, you know, videos with music are the most popular form of video online, and people really want to make them. So, you know, kind of like the same question you might have had with Instagram when it came out, like, do people really want to share these arty kind of photographs with each other? We think the answers are resounding yes.
Scott Snibbe is CEO of iGroove. He'll be speaking this afternoon as part of ASU's Digital Culture Speaker Series on campus in Tempe. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Is student debt in America an economic bubble that may explode with the impact of a $1.16 trillion bomb?
This week, 15 students who took out loans to attend a number of for-profit universities owned by Corinthian College in California announced they're going on a debt strike.
Wall Street has rigged the system against us.
The debts we have are not legitimate.
We shouldn't be forced into debt to cover basic needs like healthcare, housing, and education.
Their action, which is being led by a New York-based national group called the Debt Collective, is a statement specifically against the practices of Corinthian, which they say uses dubious legal and ethical techniques to attract students to its colleges, and those techniques have been challenged in court. But they're also making a broader statement about student debt across the board and its impact on the economy. Ann Larson is an organizer with the Debt Collective. Welcome.
Hi.
What do you think this particular 15-student case is all about? Is it a trigger for something much bigger, potentially?
Well, these 15 students attended a for-profit university owned by Corinthian, and they were led into a debt trap. And so they owe thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases, for a degree that didn't lead to a job, for an education that was substandard. And this institution is well known for preying on people who are low income, for single mothers, people who don't have a lot of support networks in their lives and are looking for a way to improve their circumstances. So this predatory institution marketed themselves to these students, got them into all this debt, and now they can't repay. That school is now being sued by the federal government and several state agencies, and our argument is that their student debt should be completely canceled. There's a $1.3 trillion student debt problem in the United States. These students are sort of on the leading edge of taking the offense and saying we need to do something about this, and we're not going to wait for policy leaders or elected officials to do the right thing. We are going to demand justice.
Now, my presumption is that Corinthian would say, no, we're just a school that's offering a service, and these students understood what they were in for. How would you say the Corinthian case, and we don't need to critique Corinthian particularly, reflects a general pattern where the environment of available credit produces a lot of very opportunistic lenders out there?
Well, Corinthian is basically funded by the public. 90% of their revenue comes from tax dollars. They are reliant on the federal student loan program. So for over two decades, they took money from a public source, student loans, and they used it to enrich themselves, enrich investors. And then the students were left holding the bag at the end of the day. So what we see in the for-profit sector is really not that different in some ways than in higher education more generally, because public colleges, their budgets are being cut. We now know that student tuition makes up more of the cost of attending college than public sources did a few years ago. So more of the burden of attending college is falling on individuals and on families. So what's happening in the for-profit sector is really a harbinger of things to come in public higher education.
So the inflation that's going on in higher education, mm-hmm. Because public sources are not available
right.
anymore, and endowments
right.
are possibly challenged in some way. Mm-hmm. It means that debt is the place where the money's
coming.
So
more
from.
And more for middle and working class families, going into debt is the only way to get a college education. And it didn't used to be that way, and it certainly doesn't have to be that way. It's a matter of priorities of how we want to fund higher education in America. And we've gotten into this mindset where it seems perfectly acceptable to spend tens of thousands of dollars and go into decades of debt to get a college degree. And we really need to start rethinking that system.
It's a competitive business. It's a service that's highly valued by people all over the world. The counterargument would be, look, you know, this is the growth of the business. And this is just exactly what happens mm-hmm. in a situation where you're really, really successful.
Well, who was successful in this case? A few investors. The Department of Education makes a lot of money servicing student loans. The students here are left with nothing. They are worse off than when they began. I mean, let's think about that for a minute, that in America, you could go to college, do what you're supposed to do, follow the rules, and you end up being worse off.
Now, you're making an argument of fairness, but Janet Yellen of the Federal Reserve would make an argument that, in fact, if all those millennials with graduate degrees with all that debt are unable to enter the economy and buy homes, then that is going to affect everybody. Do you believe that this debt overhang is a huge economic bubble waiting to burst?
Well, sure. It seems, you know, the people who have a lot of student debt, we know, don't buy houses. They don't buy cars. They're very slow to start their own families. And that's a problem. I mean, it's undeniable. But I think the other issue here is that this is really a moral and ethical question also, not just purely economic. Is it right to allow young people just starting out in life to take on more debt than they can ever repay, to put them in a situation where they cannot get a job with the credential that they have, and just allow them to be sucked dry by investors, by the Department of Education, and by their school? Is that the kind of society we want to have?
And let's just look at the question for an advocate of how leveraged some of these institutions are. If a lot more than just 15 people were to take into their own hands the matter of their student debt and strike, mm-hmm. How much leverage do students have in forcing banks to change their tactics and schools to change their tactics?
I think they could have a lot of leverage. $1 trillion, you know, we have a saying on our website that if you owe the bank $1,000, the bank owns you. But if you owe the bank $1 trillion, then you own the bank.
Well, what do you say to the student who says, well, you know, that's all very fine and good for you to make that sort of manifesto argument, but if you don't win, then my credit rating is ruined if I join your debt collective?
Sure. There are risks, absolutely. Not paying your debt. We wouldn't say anyone should do that on their own. That's why we're trying to form unions and collectivities and communities so people can support each other. It's a scary thing. There are very serious consequences. That's one of the things we're trying to make the public aware of, that not paying your student debt has serious costs, and that's why we need to do it in a planned way and as a union and together, and we need to be negotiating with creditors and lenders and telling them what our demands are.
Ann Larson is an organizer with the Debt Collective. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways. John Hockenberry.
Good afternoon. This is the show, a mix of local, national, and international news and culture.
KJZZ is supported by Cohen Media Group presenting Deli Man, a documentary chronicling more than 160 years of Jewish tradition, served up by deli owners, operators, and pastrami fanatics, starring Jerry Stiller and Larry King, in theaters Friday.
The Valley is putting the spotlight on its entrepreneurs this week during Phoenix Startup Week. When you think Valley and startup, this one may not be the first one to come to mind, but Sydney Peck, director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU, says maybe it should be.
It is, I mean, for lack of a better word, absolutely incredible what is happening in our startup ecosystem. So I have been in Arizona for 8 years, and when in my second year here is when I first attempted to start a business with a co-founder. And the environment that I faced about 6 or 7 years ago versus the environment as it is today couldn't be more different. We're finally starting to really go after the same message and move in the same direction and collaborate more and be more transparent. And it's fascinating how far we've come and how supportive this ecosystem is.
What's changed?
You know, I think it's a number of things. There are a lot of young entrepreneurs who are growing up in Arizona, whether they are graduates of ASU or U of A or NAU or came to Arizona for another reason, maybe from another regional school after they graduated. But we have a lot of very active young entrepreneurs. And at the core of an entrepreneurial ecosystem are, of course, the entrepreneurs.
On the policy side, have things become easier for entrepreneurs to get their startups off the ground?
I am not someone who believes that policy is necessarily the reason that an entrepreneurship ecosystem is thriving. Certainly, there might be reasons to grow companies elsewhere if different policies are not favorable, but from what I know, it's the people and the networks, the mentors, the programs, the learning opportunities that create an ecosystem. So I'm not really someone who believes that policy influences it strongly one way or another. If you look at Silicon Valley, the tax policy is very not optimal for a business owner. And so that's not a reason that's slowing them down. And so I think we have just fine policy, but I don't think that's a reason.
So if not policy, are there other things that maybe could change or evolve to make things even better for startups in Arizona? Are there things that still need to happen to get Arizona to where folks like yourself want it to be?
Sure. I think it's continuing to do more of what we're doing. So you see here, we're now the fourth city that's having a city-titled Startup Week, the Phoenix Startup Week, that's happening in cities all over the Phoenix metro area. So this is a sign that people in the community are willing to give their time. I think we're doing all the right things. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think we have solid leaders who are pushing it. And I think we just need to keep doing it. Something like a startup ecosystem, having all the right things in play, doesn't happen overnight. And I would say we've got a good 3 to 5 years of solid forward momentum, and we need another 3 to 5 years to make it into a nationally or globally recognized city for startups. So I think just doing more of what we're doing, you'll hear a lot of people say we wish we had more capital in the city, but I think we're all finding ways around that and getting more creative with the way we fund businesses.
Do you find that the people who are doing startups right now in the Phoenix area are people who are either from here or maybe came here to go to school, as opposed to people who just had an idea sort of in the world and decided to come here to start their business?
I would say it's mostly people who have been transplanted here for one reason or another, whether it's school or family or maybe a previous business or job, and have seen how ripe the ecosystem is here and were probably ignited to start something. I won't discount that people have moved here to start businesses, but the people that I'm most familiar with are those who are already here. And I think that's true of a lot of cities. And the benefit of starting in the city where you are is that you have a network. You're familiar with the right people who need to get you through each of the different resource stages that your business needs.
Sydney Peck is director of the Center for Entrepreneurship, which is housed in the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Sydney, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Arizona Opera's newest production is Mozart's The Magic Flute, which was first performed in Austria in 1791. Since the beginning, it's had a fairy tale feel, but Arizona Opera's take brings steampunk into the mix, sort of like dropping in the influence of H.G. Wells or Jules Verne. I went backstage at Phoenix Symphony Hall and talked steampunk style with costume designer Leslie Bernstein.
The whole concept is nature versus reason or innovation. So the innovation and reason part is where the steampunk comes in.
So I guess, what are some things that stand out about costuming steampunk? What are some things people would be familiar with if they think about, I think people think about the goggles in part?
Yeah, for sure. They would think about goggles and sort of protective leathers and gloves, and we have lots of gauntlet gloves, and we have sort of Victorian is the base of the show. So basically it's Tamino's dream, and he's a Victorian man. So we kind of use Victorian as the base. And also steampunk can also be set in like the Wild West, but for our version it's Victorian.
Did you know a lot about steampunk beforehand? Were you excited to work in that particular motif?
It's funny. I would say I was first aware of it when I was very interested in punk, goth, industrial music, and people started wearing like very kind of industrial clothing. So sort of industrial sort of turned into this steampunk look for me. It was more of like a musical thing where I would see it. So for me, it's really interesting that it's become this huge, massive interest, and people are, you know, literature is picking it up, and people are going back to Mary Shelley, and people are, you know, there's all kinds of worlds that have popped out of that one sort of idea that I was sort of only a part of a slight bit.
So is there an inherent attitude then that comes with designing that kind of thing, and what you want sort of the performers to give off with that?
Yes, definitely. So for our, it's very funny because for our Tamino, I had him very classic Victorian, you know, in a sort of a cutaway gray coat and very kind of classic. And then Dan and I, the director Dan Ragazzi and I, were sort of looking at it going, you know, he needs to be like a little more intense here. And we found this like silver leather floor length coat that was just like very kind of rock and roll in a way. And so there's a lot of elements like that that kind of are unexpected that we kind of added so that there was a little more, I guess, edge or a little toughness to it all. So these are some of the costumes that were rented. So the chorus women's costumes eventually will be built. But for here, we had a very short amount of time to build a lot of stuff. So we decided to rent some of these things. And I wanted them to feel Victorian and have a little bit of a Renaissance feel. So they're basically Victorian. The men are underdressed Victorian, and then their robes and over things are Renaissance. So this like secret society is looking back to the Renaissance, and they're, you know, represented in these beautiful gold frames. So when we see this photo, basically, of the women's chorus, we're seeing sort of Victorian mixed with Renaissance. There's some little animals that pop out in the Enchanted Forest, and they're kind of in fencing gear with steampunk elements. So this is the lynx jacket, and he's got a little cape, and he's got this crazy crown of ferns and his little spiky wig and stuff like that. And this is the rabbit, and he's got steampunk goggles and a Victorian top hat. This is another animal, the deer or the stag. And we're using sort of found objects that the kids might have put together, so like sort of Lost Boys-esque. Mm-hmm.
And so the steampunk goggles, I mean, if people see them, they'll know, but how would you describe those?
I would say they are welding goggles with gold brushed paint on a lot of them, or some of them light up. We have a frog that his eyes, his steampunk goggles are lit up and with LEDs, and then we have an owl whose eyes are going to be blinking, and that kind of thing.
Leslie Bernstein, she's the costume designer for Arizona Opera's production of The Magic Flute, which runs Friday through Sunday at Phoenix Symphony Hall.
Be sure to join us tomorrow for the show, How Close Should Regulators Be to Those They're Regulating? And A Piece of Phoenix's Past Tries a Comeback in a Different Form. Those stories and much more coming up tomorrow at 2 on the show.
And if you're looking for something to do tonight, the Parada del Sol Rodeo starts at 7 at Westworld in Scottsdale.
You can also check out the Arizona Blues Project. That's tonight at Harold's Cave Creek Corral.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are the digital team. The news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is the convivial one, John Hoban.
I'm not even sure what that means.
I'm
sure it's good. We always want to hear from you. We want to know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. You can find us at the show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great afternoon. It's 3 o'clock.